What's up, Bay Area? This is DJ Netta, and you're tuned in to Berkeley Liberation Radio, 104.1 FM in the East Bay, and on the web at berkeleyliberationradio.net. This is Radio Autonomía, Autonomy Radio, Zapatismo in the Bay. Our collective media project takes inspiration from the Zapatista movement in Chiapas, Mexico, and focuses on autonomous political, economic, and social projects in the Bay Area that resonate with the anti-capitalist rebel spirit of Zapatismo. We're here the first Sunday of every month from 4 to 6 p.m. To listen to and download past Radio Autonomía segments and shows, visit our website at radioautonomia.wordpress.com. If you have any questions, comments, suggestions, or you want to get involved, shoot us a message at radioautonomia@gmail.com.
On today's show for Radio Autonomía, we'll start out with a report from DJ Plebe covering a recent day of action in Sevilla, Spain, which happened on November 24th. This day of action was focused on popular housing issues. About 500 to 1,000 people came out from all over Andalusia, and apartment buildings were occupied, one with 18 units in it, and by the end of the day, it was filled up with people who have lost their homes. That story will be followed by the return of our Durito Story Hour segment, honoring civil society and paying tribute to those who fight for it. We'll also hear an interview with Emery Douglas, former Minister of Culture of the Black Panther Party, in Chiapas as part of his new art and media project with the Zapatista communities called Zapantera Negra. From there, we'll move to Mexico City to discuss the violent repression against protesters yesterday in the context of the inauguration of the new president, Enrique Peña Nieto. And finally, our last segment is a recording of two of the panels from last month's event at The Holdout here in Oakland. The event, as we know, is called Our Lips Are Sealed, Grand Jury Resistance. And we had this event covered on our November show. We had an interview with one of the organizers discussing that event that happened shortly thereafter. These panels discuss the history and current context of grand jury, federal grand juries as a mode of state repression and criminalization of dissent, as well as strategies for community resistance against grand juries and how we can increase our own power to fight against the state by using alternative media. So we've got quite a full show here with lots of different themes, and we're going to go first to music as usual.
Ready to begin?
Thank you.
In the context of a massive recession and harsh austerity measures, the housing crisis in Spain is becoming increasingly acute. In the last 4 years, around 400,000 people have been evicted across the country. Add to that the well-known national unemployment figures of 25% and over 50% for the youth. It's gotten so bad here that foreclosure-related suicides are on the rise. This past week, a man named Manuel Reguera killed himself in the state of Navarra upon receiving an eviction notice. He was the fourth suicide in the last month and a half or so. A fifth person tried to kill himself by jumping out of his balcony, but survived the fall. And yet, the most recent census data shows that between 3 and 6 million housing units are empty across the country. That's between 10 and 20% of the country's residential housing. November 24th was a day of action for the universal right to housing in the southernmost Spanish state of Andalusia. People from cities all across the region, even from Madrid, came together in Sevilla, representing individuals, collectives, organizations, unions, more formalized NGOs, and of course social movements like the 15M or Indignados movement. The goal of the day was to share stories and experiences and to help constitute a unified front of actors fighting in a variety of ways and from diverse political orientations for the right to decent and dignified housing. Some people shared their stories of housing precarity over a large sound system while others continued to show up. Some arrived marching and in groups. One notable example was the group of around 30 occupiers of all ages and genders from the Corrala Utopia, which showed up with a massive banner and loud chants. The Corrala Utopia is the name that's been given to an apartment building taken over back in May by a group of homeless and marginally housed folks and activists associated with the 15M movement. Its 36 apartments had been empty for years, and the real estate developer had gone bankrupt, so the building now provides housing for about 100 residents who organize themselves through collective assemblies and have sparked new conversations about housing and politics from below across Spain. The Plaza de Pumarejo, the public plaza where everything was taking place, also has an important part in this history. At the head of the plaza is a casa palacio called the Casa de Pumarejo. Basically, it's an old palace that was built in the 18th century and later sold and transformed at the end of the 19th century into a set of residential apartments. In the late 1990s, a hotel company bought the palace, hoping to turn it into a luxury hotel. Residents pushed back and brought together the community to defend the space, a process which successfully got the building declared as a historic site, thus preventing it from demolition or modification. Even more important was the community that formed through this struggle. While the top floor continued to serve as apartments, the bottom floor was turned into a community organizing center called the Centro Vecinal del Pumarejo. Now there are a number of collectives and projects that work out of there, including an organization that does work with migrants, a renters' rights group, and even an alternative social currency called the Puma. So the Casa del Pumarejo provided a perfect backdrop for the day of action. I asked Amparo and Nico, two compañeros affiliated with the Corrala Utopia, to describe the scene. For me, today is a really important day because we're seeing that little by little, we're bringing together more and more people. More people from many different cities, not just one. And everyone can see that we're not alone. And also, to set the scene, I don't think there's a better place where we could be doing this.
The best thing so far today is that we're in the plaza in front of the Casa del Pumarejo, with its intense history of struggle to keep the building from being destroyed. Residents and community members have been fighting with developers and the city government for many years. So, to describe the scene, there are people who pretty much live here because they come to the Centro Vecinal. There are people who've been activists for years, but at the same time, there are people who have never been associated with any organization, who come from more marginalized neighborhoods and face serious struggles in everyday life. And they've decided to come today to fight for the right to housing. For example, that girl over there in the purple shirt. She's pregnant, and in fact, yesterday she passed her due date, and she's over there with her boyfriend because she's been affected by the housing crisis, and she can't think of a better place to be right now. She's 20 years old, from the Macarena, and is one of these people who had never been to a protest before. But through the movement for the right to housing, here she is. And there are a lot of folks just like her.
¿Cuál es el plan para después? ¿Qué vamos a hacer durante ese día de acción? Bueno, el plan, la verdad que es una jornada de convivencia y lucha a la vez, ¿no? Entonces,
the plan for today is a combination of conviviality, of just being here together, on the one hand, and of struggle on the other hand. Collectives from other cities have started to arrive. There's folks here from Granada, Málaga, Córdoba, Jaén, and even from Madrid. We started off the day with an encuentro involving everyone. People were talking about the situation they're in and the importance of what we're doing today, where the people from below come together to constitute this power. Then we had some lunch. The Yayo Flautas made an amazing white bean stew that we're all sitting here trying to digest.
Yayo Flautas are grandparents who, in their role as grandparents, have decided to rise up. Frequently, older folks say, well, I already fought my own fight, now it's the youth's turn. But because younger folks are basically drowning due to their economic situation, they've decided that as grandparents, and in a way as the engine of Spain, because they take care of their grandkids when their own kids, the parents, go out to work. They've decided to go out and establish themselves as a collective. Also, they feed us.
They're a very important collective because, in the end, they've been fighting their whole lives. In large part, they're the ones who won the rights that are being taken away from us now. So it's hard for us to imagine what it's like for them, who actually won in their time. I can fight for myself, for my mom. If I had kids, I would fight for them, for what's around me. They fight for those same things, but also for their own kids and grandkids. And it's amazing that they still have the force to keep fighting. Anyway, getting back to the plan of action for today, now that we've finished lunch, we're going to hang out here for a bit and keep talking and sharing. Then at 5, there's a protest in front of the Andalusian Parliament, and from there, we'll march to the Setas, which is an icon of struggle in Sevilla, because it was the central meeting and assembly site for the 15M movement over the last couple years. So, like Nico said, around 5 p.m., people started to head over to the Parliament building. At first, while everybody was gathering, the group was standing on the sidewalk. But once we reached a critical mass, I would say of about 500 or 700 people, we moved into the street and blocked traffic on one of the city's main avenues. Then, behind dozens of massive banners, the march took off. There were banners representing a variety of political messages, from slogans defending the right to housing that's enshrined in the Spanish Constitution, to more radical slogans rejecting the state and opting instead for mutual aid and solidarity. One banner read, "No pedimos limosna, rescatamos la dignidad." We're not asking for charity, we're reclaiming dignity. Went up one of Sevilla's main avenues, then turned onto the Calle Feria, a street that runs through the neighborhood called the Alameda, that surrounds a plaza of the same name. Over the last decade or two, this area has experienced significant gentrification. Apartments have been bought, renovated, and flipped. The plaza itself has been torn up and redone. The mercadillo, or flea market, that used to take place on Sundays here and formed an important part of the informal economy that helped the city's poorer and marginalized populations get by, has been expelled. And a brand new modern police station has been built right at the edge of the plaza. The march entered the plaza and should have taken a left turn to head up towards its final destination, but instead took a detour and went up the street adjacent to the police station. Everybody was confused by the route, but all of a sudden, two blocks up from the plaza, the second floor windows of a building opened up and people dropped enormous banners from the balcony reading, "Corrala la ilusión." A new corrala had been occupied. José García, a spokesperson for the occupiers, explained the story with the building.
Era una mobiliaria que construyó los pisos en 2008, después los ha reformado, supongo que va a intentar reducir...
The building is owned by a developer which built and renovated the apartments in 2008. But since then, none of them have sold because the prices continue to be bubble prices, so the developer is holding on to them and basically hoping to be bailed out with public money. The protest started at 5 and at around 5:30 or 6, the march took a detour and arrived here at this building, whose 18 apartments had already been occupied by the families.
While there's recently been serious street fighting between riot police and demonstrators in Madrid and Barcelona, for example during the general strike on November 14th, in Sevilla things have generally been pretty calm. But that night, the cops attacked. Maybe it was because the occupied building was right around the corner from the police station and the cops felt stupid. Or maybe we can just chalk it up to cops acting like cops. But for whatever reason, as soon as some of the protesters left to continue their march to the Setas, riot cops moved in and attacked those remaining in front of the building with batons. They arrested 5 people, including a camera person working for a TV station called La Sexta, no relation to the Zapatistas, and confiscated her camera. All of them were charged with ridiculous charges like trespassing, which was absurd because it was impossible for any of them to go in the building, since the doors were never opened. After the police assault, the march returned to the New Corrala to support them. The police were face down and slowly but surely retreated. At no time was the Corrala actually threatened with eviction. I actually walked by the occupation a couple days ago and it's still going strong, joining the Corrala Utopia as a new and inspiring fixture in the ruined urban landscape of Sevilla. Reporting from the front lines of the struggle against austerity in the poorest region of Spain, this is DJ Plebe for Radio Autonomía.
You are back listening to Radio Autonomia, Zapatismo in the Bay on Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1. And we are about to go into, we're bringing back the Dorito Story Hour. And this Story Hour is a communique called to Lady Civil Society. And this was written in February of 96. And it's just a portion of the communique, but it's kind of a conversation between Subcomandante Marcos and his knight errant, or the little beetle, Dorito, talking about the role of civil society and how civil society can't necessarily be followed or led, but as we should walk together with ordinary people and those people below and to the left to figure out and make a new world. So with that, we're going to jump into that, and then we will be back.
For this month's Dorito Story Hour, we'll be reading a communique entitled To Lady Civil Society. It was written in February 1996 by Subcomandante Marcos, and it was addressed to the National and International Civil Society. Alleged Zapatista prisoners, in prison because they are alleged, and because they are Zapatistas. In prisons are those who want a free, just, and democratic country. Free are the presumptuous, corrupt ones, free to be corrupt and to be presumptuous. Free are those who sold a nation's freedom, those who mock justice, those who define democracy as that's bullshit. The alleged Zapatista prisoners, imprisoned by Mexican soldiers who decorate their service records with the expulsion of the inhabitants of Guadalupe Tepeyac, with the destruction of Prado, with the demolition of the library of the Aguas Calientes, by Mexican soldiers like those who spend their salary on the prostitutes that their superiors administer, Mexican soldiers who do not understand why the children of Guadalupe Tepeyac insult each other, they call their offenders soldiers, by Mexican soldiers like those in the crews of the three helicopters that disappeared in January 1996 without a trace, by Mexican soldiers like Mexican soldiers who from the ranks of the Federal Army realized they were deceived. For years they were taught that their duty was to defend the homeland, and now they find themselves pursuing indigenous people, like themselves, in Chiapas, Tabasco, Guerrero, Veracruz, Oaxaca, Hidalgo, Michoacán, Jalisco, and in any state of the Federation suspected of being a place where poor Mexicans reside. But didn't the politicians tell them that it was a question of only one group of transgressors of the law, whose strength was limited to four municipalities? Didn't they teach them that the one they called General, last name Cardenas, first name Lazaro, returned to Mexico what belonged to it? From the news, the Mexican soldiers find out that the oil wells they are taking in Tabasco will not be for Mexicans, but for a client with a different flag than the one with the eagle devouring a serpent. From the news, they find out that the oil profits that are the goal of Operation Rainbow in La Candona already have a destination, and that the future owner speaks a language foreign to this history of these soils. From the news, they learn that the U.S. government is militarizing the border with Mexico, while they, the Mexican soldiers, are ordered to militarize the borders of Mexico with Mexico. From the news, they learn that the commander-in-chief, Mr. President, is getting the highest homage that Europe bestows upon a salesman. Mexican soldiers begin to question what they're doing persecuting Mexicans. Where did the homeland and its history go? Where did honor and shame go? But we weren't talking about soldiers. At least we weren't talking about soldiers armed with guns or with sticks, says Dorito, who insists that the boots are the problem. We were talking about Lady Civil Society and of how, when no one knew what to do, I'm talking about politicians and members of the military, regardless of their leanings and uniform. She knew what to do, and surprise, she did it. When the time and smell of gunpowder and blood, salty like sweat, had passed, and after we sent those letters to National and International Civil Society, someone wrote to me, and among other things, asked me why we insisted so much in addressing civil society, since it was an entity that didn't exist. For those in power, what cannot be accounted for doesn't exist, says my other self, who has a flair for axioms and skepticism. And that we were naive to hope for something from civil society, that it could never achieve, the transition to democracy. Well, I told myself, because I didn't even answer the letter in writing, we have never hoped that civil society will achieve the transition to democracy. What we have hoped for, and still hope for, is that civil society may achieve something somewhat more complicated and indefinable as herself, a new world, the
difference between now and then is that now we want to participate along with her in that dream that may deliver us from the nightmare. We don't seek to direct her, but neither to follow her. We want to go with her, march by her side. Are we hopelessly naive? Maybe. But against realist cynicism, naivety may produce, for example, a January 1st. And just look at the heap of dreams brought about by January 1st. So we have nothing to lose. Lady Civil Society and the Zapatistas share the contempt that big politicians have for us. We share an undefinable face and a diffuse name. Why not share a dream? Believe me, no matter what happens when we awake, they'll always be better, infinitely better, than the nightmare we are now suffering. Well then, allow me to salute through these letters those men and women who are Zapatista political prisoners. Allow me to salute their determination and their dignity. Allow me to salute the indigenous people of Chiapas, those men and women who have preferred a dignified example to a comfortable surrender. But above all, allow me to salute Lady Civil Society, the men and women who do not exist, who have no name, who are without a face. Allow me to thank them for existing, for having a little known name and having a face like any other. Allow me to give them a present, not a promise nor an intention, a flower, yes, a red flower. Red not for blood or for ideas, red just because I didn't find any other. Red because it's the color the moon turns when she blushes, full-faced, if she looks at herself in the mountain's mirror, and the mountain gives her a back. As well, the best image of herself. A red flower that carefully considered is also a promise and an intention. Vale, salud. And may the red flower never lack water or hope. From the mountains of the Mexican southeast, Subcomandante Insurgente Marcos. P.S. That polemicizes. Torito has shown enthusiasm about the red flower. He proposes a carnation that goes well with knight errantry, in addition to bullfighting. My other self is more traditional and leans towards roses. I say that there is no rose or carnation that can equal that moon that blooms up above, nor a gift bigger than the one that, without possessing it, we already have.
Apúrate, 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 apúrate. esas son las consecuencias. No sé dónde va a parar otro guerrillero más.
Listening to Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 FM, and this is Radio Autonomía, Zapatismo in the Bay. And what we are about to transition into now is a special segment. It's an interview with Emery Douglas, former Minister of Culture of the Black Panther Party, who recently participated in an encuentro as part of a new project that he has going with the Zapatista communities in Chiapas. So this is a sort of interesting way to link up our local history here in Oakland, you know, the site of the birth of the Black Panther Party, with with the theme of our show, right, with the Zapatista movement and Zapatista politics. So the little segment that we're going to hear starts out with an intro that gives the overview of the project in the words of Emery Douglas and the organizers of the Zapantera Negra. That's the Zapatista, Pantera Negra, Zapatista, and Black Panther combined to create that name. So we're going to hear the overview of the project and then a brief interview with Emery Douglas that was recently conducted in Morelia, in the Caracol of Morelia in Chiapas. So we're going to go to that segment now. Just a few weeks ago, in the mountains of Chiapas, Mexico, an encounter took place, an encuentro called Zapantera Negra, Black Panthers meets the Zapatista rebels. Here's some text from the overview of the project. At the peak of its popularity in 1970, 139,000 copies of the Black Panther newsletter were distributed throughout the United States on a weekly basis. Within its pages, Emery Douglas, the movement's Minister of Culture, published his artworks in an effort to, quote, illustrate conditions that made revolution seem necessary and construct a visual mythology of power for people who felt powerless and victimized. The newsletter and its accompanying illustrations played a central role in the articulation of the "What We Want, What We Believe" portion of the Black Panther's 10-point program. In 1994, the Zapatista Uprising, a Mexican indigenous movement originating in the southern state of Chiapas, generated and disseminated a different sort of mass communication made possible by the rise of the internet. Photographic, video, and written information regarding the movement's actions spread around the world in real time, increasing awareness of the Zapatista cause while also building solidarity for what the New York Times termed, quote, the first postmodern revolution. Positioning itself as a struggle against neoliberalism waged against 500 years of oppression, Zapatismo has employed new technologies of information distribution in order to articulate their wants, beliefs, and various identities to themselves and to their global audience. The Black Panther and the Zapatista movements occurred in distinct cultural, political, and historical milieus. Nonetheless, the two share a common appreciation of the power of the image and the written word to build their respective social movements into personal, collective, transformative, and public experiences. In contrast to the strong self-definition established and disseminated by these two movements via pertinent media channels, today's multimedia plugged-in landscape seems to promote the opposite development. Today we tweet, text, and browse through myriad contexts, occasionally gaining a glimpse into the exterior world, but more frequently losing ourselves in the internet's echo chamber of opinions and perspectives. Zapantera Negra, ZPN, will be a single-run magazine of 20,000 full-color copies that will merge the powerful imagery and layout style of Emery Douglas with the visions and voices of Zapatista painters and embroidery collectives. It will bring the two similar movements together on the page to demonstrate their commonalities, tie the movements to the present, and articulate a new collaborative interdisciplinary mode of information distribution and political, social, and economic self-identification. Zapatera Negra will be distributed in 5 countries and within select educational, artistic, and political institutions. Its project coordinators hope to develop a grassroots distribution network that will also allow for its dissemination to communities with little access to alternative media. The newsletter will also have a social media platform where friends, followers, and fans will be able to download, print, and wheat paste the newsletter on overpasses and walkways. The newsletter production and distribution will be paralleled by the production of a collection of tapestries made by Zapatista embroidering collectives that merge and exchange Black Panther imagery as articulated by Emery Douglas with that of the Zapatista movement. This work is an attempt to highlight the positive and transformative roles that art has played within social, cultural, and revolutionary movements in promoting the possibilities of imagining other worlds. It's also a project that demonstrates how contemporary art practices sidestep between the traditionally political and conceptual performative works from the ground up within communities of struggle, as opposed to contemporary high art practices taught by leading art institutions. This is a grassroots effort to bring together two very powerful visual and political social movements of our time. And in times of much revolutionary fever and economic insecurity, we feel it's important to share what art can and has done to create change and break society's notions of normality.
Okay, so first, Emery, why are you here in Chiapas in the Caracol Morelia?
Well, I was invited to do an artist in residency and to also come and to do some graphic work with the at the Zapatista communities here in Chiapas.
Is this your first time here?
Yes, this is my first time here.
Okay, so what's your relationship with the Zapatista movement?
Well, I guess it's because in solidarity and relationship to their struggle for the basic human rights is the tangible connection that we have together. Of course, they started, in, I believe, 1980s or some point in the 1980s, whereas the Black Panther Party had been over by 1981. But it's in the spirit of what they represent symbolically, it's the connection between the Black Panther Party of that era and the Zapatistas.
Mm-hmm. What is like, if you can say, like the strongest connection between the Panteras Negras or the Black Panther Party and the Zapatista struggle?
Well, it was looking about self-determination, trying to determine and define our own destiny for our communities and ourselves, and developing our own social order and programs and institutions.
So what's
and our resistance against that, against the state oppression.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you have seen so much of the Zapatista movement until now, but what do you think, like after like seeing maybe a little glimpse of it here in Chiapas?
Well, I see it's growing, taking it at their own pace, but determined. So it's an ongoing process that I see.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, like the experience of the Black Panther Party in the United States, but here in Chiapas, you know, you have a militarization of the Zapatista area. It's like the most militarized state in Mexico, and political prisoners. And what do you think about that? Like the repression that the Black Panther Party suffered also in the
Yes. You have the same. It's the repression is universal in its aggression against those who oppose injustice, and you have political prisoners worldwide. You still have many Black Panthers who are incarcerated from the 1960s and 70s, over 40 years ago, and so symbolically there's a link there as well.
Mm-hmm. Have there been like any connection between the Black Panther Party and the Zapatista movement before?
No, not really. Only through maybe some people coming back and forth through the states and making us aware of the Zapatista struggle. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what do you do now? Like you say, the Black Panther Party was over in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Have you like brought the struggle with you?
We continue. We know it was state repression that exploited our internal limitations as young people and create dissension within the ranks that caused us to the party to implode on itself. But at the same time, since then, we've all many of us who are still alive or can still breathe and challenge the system continue to do that. And we come together all together from time to time to honor our legacy and to pass it on to many young people who are interested in that history. So we continue to do that. Myself, I travel quite a bit, and I talk about it, put in retrospective the history of the party through the artwork that I did during that time.
Mm-hmm. And do you think this exchange between the Zapatista movement and with your artwork can do like can reach out to new people, like so that new generation can hear about the Black Panther Party, but also about, you can say, a forgotten struggle by the Zapatista movement?
Yes, of course, for definitely. I know I would be doing more investigative research into the movement and to incorporate it into some of the artwork that I do. Hopefully, I'll be able to come back again, and I will, for sure, when I do my presentation, talk about the my visit here and how impressed I was with the visit. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, but when you travel around, you say in the United States doing your work, what kind of relationship people have to the struggle of maybe not only the Black Panther Party, but the struggle of the black people in the United States?
Oh, well, they have a strong resistance going on because of the collapse of the economy. Mm-hmm. So you got many, many folks who are now wishing they had been those who were around then, younger people who are desire for the types of programs and alternative kind of structures that the Black Panther Party was presenting and implementing during that time. Mm-hmm. So they wish for them today. Mm-hmm. So, but of course, it's more complicated now than it was then to do those types of programs. But also, it's not just traveling in the United States. I travel all over the so far all over the world. Been invited by the people to travel. Not that I reach out and program or market myself. It's just that people have asked me because of the interest. And so, you know, I've been to Australia 3 times, New Zealand, Beirut, Lebanon, the UK many, many times, Portugal 2, 2x, so continue. And now here in Mexico, Zapatistas, yeah, mm-hmm. Chiapas, mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
That's good. Mm-hmm. And what was my question? I lost it. Okay, but I can. So, while you're staying here, you're doing this residence with Edelo. Can you tell us a little bit about...
Yes, well, I was at Caleb. I met Caleb in San Francisco. He came and we hooked up some years back. I met Caleb in San Francisco and some years back, and it was thereafter that he had wanted to know if I was interested in doing the artist in residence coming. And once it was agreed that when I would come, and so I came to, and he wanted me to visit the Zapatistas community as well as do some, be there to be honored in conjunction with young artists from the Zapatista community who were inspired by the work that I did and created some images and embroidery painting, illustrations, or embroidery design, crafts of some of the work that I did as a part of the exhibit. And it was really amazing work that I seen. Very impressed, very heartwarming to see how inspired people were about around the images themselves.
Yeah. Can you tell a little bit about the images? Since this is audio, people can't, so they can visualize what was made out of your...
Well, they were embroidered. Some of the prints of historical retrospective prints that I did from the 1960s were, you could say, remixed but embroidered as opposed to being painted and cloth and needle and thread kinds of thing into big wall painting, wall type paintings, but of embroidery.
And now they're part of an exhibition?
At Edelo, yes, it's there. It's for, I'm not sure how long, but it's there right now, yes.
Uh-huh. And is there some plan to bring all of this back to United States? Or?
No, I have no idea how they what their plans are. I also contributed about 36 more recent prints that I've remixed, some I remixed, and some of more recent art that was also included in the exhibit. So I have no idea about how they will use it in the future. Yeah.
But you say you want to come back, but you are coming back in December, maybe?
Yes, in December I'll become. I've been invited back. Yes, and so I definitely will be back in December for sure. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And is it? Can you say something about?
I'm here. It's for the symposium that they have on the indigenous people around the world. Will be and many other folks will be coming for the symposium that they have here, and so I've been invited to do a presentation in December. So I'll be here for that. Yes, for sure.
Okay. And some other plans about doing some more work in Chiapas?
Pardon me?
Other plans like coming back to do some work in Chiapas?
Well, at some point, it hasn't been set in stone just yet, but for sure I'll be coming back. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Faltaba más, coronel.
Y al país lo remataron y lo remataron. ahora hay que volverlo a armar.
Liberation Radio 104.1 FM, Radio Autonomía, Zapatismo in the Bay. We're here the first Sunday of every month from 4 to 6 p.m. So we just heard a number of segments here from Spain to our friend Durito from La Selva Lacandona to Morelia de Caracol in Chiapas, where Emery Douglas, former Black Panther, was recently participating in an art encounter. And now we're going to talk a little bit about the events that took place yesterday, December 1st, in Mexico City, and really across the country as well.
Yeah.
So DJ Neta is going to give us a little bit of an overview of sort of what went down yesterday to contextualize the really extreme repression that was faced in the streets.
Yep. So we wanted to do just some quick coverage on the protests yesterday in Mexico City, which were protests against the swearing-in of Enrique Peña Nieto, which is the newly, quote, elected president of Mexico. There was a march that was called for by the National Convention Against the Imposition, which is partly associated with the other candidate, which is Obrador. And it was convoked by them and also the movement Yo Soy 132, which emerged during the elections and against Peña Nieto. They organized a march. The organization began around for the march around 4:30 a.m., but about 5 or 6 days earlier, the federal and municipal police had basically barricaded the legislative palace with massive metal. Basically a massive metal wall that hooked together but had a small opening in the middle so they could fire tear gas and rubber bullets through at the protesters. So they had obviously been thinking about response to some sort of to march and were pretty adamant on not letting any of the protesters near the legislative palace. The first confrontation began with the police around just before 7 a.m. and continued throughout the day, and in the end there were about 105 people who were injured, 29 of which needed medical attention. One person was shot in the head. I mean, it's unclear, really. The information is pretty scarce, and it's unclear whether how many people were actually injured. But there were some people who were seriously injured, shot in the head with gas canisters, shot with rubber bullets. Two people are in serious condition, probably in critical condition. And the most disturbing thing is the coverage by the news media of the protests, which in Mexico was little or none, and also in the U.S., little or none. And what coverage there were, there was of the protest by Televisa, which is a news channel affiliated with the PRI party, which is Peña Nieto's party, characterized, attempted to delegitimize the protests in a number of really troubling ways. tactics that we've seen used in the U.S., which is to affiliate any kind of protest or march with the quote-unquote black bloc. And I want to read just a couple of excerpts from a news piece which was published by 24 Horas, which is a subsidiary of Televisa, where they describe the protests yesterday as, quote, anarchists attack the Capitol. And they say protesters were distinguished by black gloves and military-style combat boots. They moved highly coordinated in formation in the shape of a half moon and in intervals of 10 to 15 minutes. And they pushed forward and regrouped and moved in different zones with specific targets. They are groups that led the most extensive battle royale in the center city of Mexico City in the history of the capital. So really, really trying to portray the protesters as an organized group of, quote, anarchists who were using military tactics. And to go on to quote the jefe de gobierno del Distrito Federal, Marcelo Ebrard,
the mayor,
he says, "This was not a mobilization that is an acceptable political protest. It was a barbarous act, and never have we had a provocation of this kind." And he says, he continues to say that clearly they wanted to provoke disorder. He continues to go on and say that the clashes were orchestrated actions by three anarchist groups, the, quote, anarchist black bloc, the, quote, anarchist black cross, and the anarchist student platform. And at the time of the publication of this report, there were 107 people detained, 11 of which were minors, 20 of which were adult women, and 76 who were adult men. And he goes on to, in this news source, 24 Horas, which is part of Televisa, goes on to try and link the protesters to foreign, to international anarchist movements by saying that apparently the members of the anarchist black bloc entered the country through the border with the state of Chiapas, kind of insinuating that they entered through Guatemala or something like that. They weren't actually Mexicans, that they were just trying to provoke chaos and disorder, which is, interestingly, a similar tactic used in the U.S. to delegitimize any sort of political movement. They continue to go on in this, and to link in any way that they can, link the protests with other guerrilla movements. And to quote the article, they say the violence coincided with the communique of a new insurgent group on the national scene, the Ejército Popular Magonista de Liberación Nacional, which is a group who came out with its first communique yesterday, and which takes Ricardo Flores Magón as their kind of symbol. But is really in no way, is there any real connection between the two, except for that this media outlet is trying to tie them in any way to any group which would delegitimize the kinds of protests. And the group, just before the swearing in of the Ejército Popular Magonista, just before the swearing in of Enrique Peña Nieto, announced in a declaration that they would begin an offensive with political and military forces in order to quicken the formation of self-defense groups and military units throughout the country. The news article goes on to delegitimate the protesters by saying that they came prepared in backpacks. They carried Molotov cocktails and firecrackers. Some of them had pipes in their hands, long chains, pickaxes, and hammers, in which a few hours later they used to break benches and street surfaces in order to have rocks to throw at the police. And then they contrast this group, the quote-unquote black bloc, with another group of protesters, the kind of pacifist student protesters. And they say that another group of protesters, at the same time, met a few meters away from the violent group, but they were unmasked. This group emphasized that the march was a peaceful protest and identified their organizations as coming from universities. The Yo Soy 132 movement and the section of the Union of Educational Workers. So again, the same kind of tactic to try and divide the protesters and put them into camps of violent and nonviolent groups in order to really delegitimate the movement in itself. And finally, they say that the masked protesters marched en route to the Zocalo, and in their wake, they destroyed city property, businesses, telephone booths, street signs, as well as engaged in looting. So there's not much coverage of the protests yesterday, but what there is really tries to stamp the protesters as a small fringe group of, well, three groups of anarchists who really just want to create disorder, rather than calling into question the legitimacy of the presidency of Peña Nieto, which is really at issue. So that's just a quick news brief from Mexico City, and Magali would like to.
So just to comment a little bit more about this, there's a few really interesting things to tie in, which is, you know, in addition to DJ Netta's really great analysis of how the mainstream media really manipulated the story to try and create this image of this, you know, violent fringe group that's really an exception to, you know, the general population. What we're seeing at the same time that these news reports were starting to come out, you know, these news reports that were painting this image in both the sort of usual sources, the very sort of right-wing, conservative mainstream media, but also in some of the more reliable, generally speaking, leftist media, was also reproducing this kind of image. What we were seeing simultaneously was the ways that social media was being used to create a very different image of what was happening, with people uploading photos directly from the street that they were taking on cell phones of alternative news agencies like Subversiones and Rebelión and various different sources that we frequently turn to, presenting very, very different versions of the story, showing, sort of ordinary people that had come out to the streets, as they have been for at least 7 months, if not more, since the campaign season, and really, you know, for the last 6 years, in response to first the fraudulent election of Felipe Calderón, and then to this sexenio, you know, the six-year administration that has been a six-year period of a violent situation of war, with over 100,000 people dead and disappeared across the country. So this kind of generalized discontent that we're seeing in the country, this generalized concern with the state of affairs and with the particular threat that Peña Nieto's presidency poses to the sort of situation for people in Mexico, we're seeing a growing climate of both political dissent, popular opposition to the sort of status quo, and increasingly violent repressive tactics on the part of the state and their best friends in the narco and various police and military institutions across the country. So as we know, Peña Nieto is a member of the PRI party, the Institutionalized Revolution Party. His election marks the return of a party that was unseated for the first time in 70 years in 2000 with the election of Fox, of Vicente Fox, who was from the PAN party. Felipe Calderón in 2006 elected also from the PAN party, an even more right-wing, if you can imagine, a more kind of economically conservative party. But the PRI, you know, that was the party that was essentially a sort of dictatorship of 70 years in power, is now back in office, ruling the country once again. Peña Nieto also notoriously is the former governor of the state of Mexico, the Estado de Mexico, which is home to the community of San Salvador Atenco, where we saw in 2006 violent, brutal repression of Otra Campaña protesters and local folks who were just rising up in their civic right to protest, changing economic and political circumstances in their communities. Otra Campaña people were there supporting, and we saw some of the most violent repression that Mexico has seen at the hands of state forces in a long time. And so, you know, the streets of Mexico City yesterday, the images coming out looked a lot like the images we saw in May of 2006 from Atenco, and it's no coincidence that this same politician is at the head of all of this. And so we just wanted to bring this to everybody's attention. And note that, you know, given this image of the protesters being violent mobs of anarchist youth, the most severely injured person yesterday, who was initially reported as having been killed in the protest because of the degree of severity of his injuries, Juan Francisco Cuiquendal, also known as Cui, who is a member of La Otra Cultura, a part of the Otra Campaña in Mexico. He has worked in support of the Frente de Pueblos por la Defensa de la Tierra in Atenco and a number of other organizations related to the Zapatista movement and the Otra Campaña, and he was shot in the head with a tear gas bomb, which we saw images of these explosives, these projectiles on the internet today and yesterday, and they look like oversized grenades. He was on the cover of La Jornada, of the Mexican newspaper today. We can see his injury. He was shot in the head, and there was literally his brain was pouring out of his skull, and he is now in a coma in the Cruz Roja in Polanco with irreversible brain damage. And this is a man of 67 years old, a theater director, and well-known politically active artist in Mexico. So our thoughts are with his family and with him, and we hope for his recovery and for the recovery and immediate release of all those who were detained yesterday. There were many, many, many arbitrary detentions of people in addition to those who find themselves in the hospital today. So we'll be following this, and we want to just kind of make the link now. We're going to go to a musical break, but when we come back, we're going to be hearing some audios like we introduced at the beginning from the grand jury resistance event, Our Lips Are Sealed, that was held at the Holdout here in Oakland about 3 weeks ago. And the reason we thought it would be good to link this up is because the common theme is the persecution and essential global witch hunt against anarchists and the painting of all criminal dissent, or all dissent as criminal, and of all protest as violent by the state. And this sort of category of anarchist is the useful category that gets used to frame all of this. And so we'll be talking or hearing from those panels about the recent repression against anarchist groups here in the West Coast. So musical break, and we'll be back.
This morning, Some of these details I don't know if are important to share, but whatever, I'm going to share them anyways because I feel like it draws a picture of like the experience that I had. And I was handcuffed without pants for a little bit, and while they went through the house and they had a search warrant for black clothes, anarchist flags, anarchist literature, anarchist flags, black flags, and maybe other stuff. That's all I remember. And after a short while, maybe an hour and a half or so, sometime in between there, I got my pants, and then they handed me a subpoena to appear before a grand jury. It turned out later that day that two other houses in Portland were raided at the same time, and that two other subpoenas were served in Olympia on the same day. Shortly after that, folk from Portland got together with a local radical lawyer, and we all had a meeting to start talking about how we wanted to respond. One of the things, the other person who was subpoenaed at the same time, Leah, in Portland to appear before the grand jury, we both decided that we didn't want to cooperate. We decided that we didn't want to cooperate in different ways. But then immediately, one of the other things that we talked about that we wanted to do is that we wanted to make it clear to a larger radical community that we were not going to cooperate. And we did that with other people who had media experience working with the media, who started up a media campaign to address that. We drafted a statement about how we weren't going to communicate or cooperate with the grand jury, and we started trying to organize with the other people who had been subpoenaed. Some lawyers, legal advice had been given to other people who were subpoenaed that they were going to try to take different tactics in dealing with the subpoena, such as filing a motion to quash, in that stating that appearing before the grand jury would cause unnecessary hardships in their life, and therefore it shouldn't be valid, and that upon advice of the lawyer that they shouldn't be open about what their intentions were, because that would possibly damage the procedural motions they were going to apply. So a few other people decided to take the approach of not being open about how they weren't going to cooperate. At the first hearing, I didn't show up, I found out that my subpoena had been dropped. I didn't know why, but what we did know at the time is that grand juries often don't investigate people who are targets of the investigation. And at a later hearing where Leah was in front of the grand jury, we found out that they had been asking questions about me. So that confirmed some of the suspicions that we had. Organizing around resisting the grand jury has looked like a lot of like talking with people and trying to find support for the other grand jury resistors. Some things that I think were important were for people who were subpoenaed to make sure they got lists of things that they needed if they were taken into custody. Getting that to people, making sure that there was liaisons with the lawyers who are going to be representing the people who were subpoenaed. And now in hindsight, something that I think is a good idea is being clear very explicitly about what the strategy is going to be, and having conversations with people like, okay, you're going to go in front of the grand jury. Precisely how do you intend to not cooperate? Well, what we found was really nice is recently, if you may have seen on the CAPER website, Maddie had the full transcript of their proceeding, and that was taken by Maddie in the courtroom. You may be allowed to take notes. They gave flack to some of the other subpoenas about taking notes and scared some of them about taking notes, and then you can get those out to your lawyer. You're able to go out and meet with your lawyer after each question, and so that's how that information go out. And I think that was really important, and I've been of the opinion from the early on that getting that information out, if you're going to take notes, and I think taking notes is a really good idea, and getting that out as soon as possible creates this transparency that not only shows other people that you're not cooperating, and again, this is your word because the grand jury is closed, but I still think it's important because it should indictments come later, like information about people cooperating will come up. But this transparency helps in showing the community that, like, hey, we're still resisting, and this is the strategy and what we're doing it with. And also, any questions that they ask about specific individuals can get out to those individuals who may have concerns about their how they're being looked into. Some of the other things about support, right, talking about how exactly you plan on resisting. One idea I've had recently is being realistic with each other about what our limitations are. Like, you may know that you have a specific diet that you need in prison, and preparing for that and preparing what you're going to do if you can't have that diet met. But like understanding that, or maybe people who are getting subpoenaed, or maybe people in your community do have psych issues, or do have children, or who may have like other dependencies, like dependencies that make it very difficult for them, that they would be easily pressured into talking. Like knowing how your community is going to support the people in your community, I think, is really important. And having those conversations up front and about knowing what people's limitations are and how we're going to support people in those limitations. I think that that's something really important. That didn't happen to the extent that I would have liked it to with the caper stuff. I don't know. I think that's all I'm going to talk. I'm going to pass this on from that. It was about 10 minutes. So we can talk more. And if people have specific questions, maybe we can get into that in the discussion section.
I'm Christian Williams. I have been working with the Committee Against Political Repression, which has been doing a lot of the support work for the grand jury resistors. I'm only going to talk shortly so that we have plenty of time for question and answer at the end, because I want to respond to like the questions that actually exist rather than just trying to guess as to what's going to be important for people to hear. I'm just going to fill in a little bit around the story that Dennison just told. So thus far there have been 5 people subpoenaed before the grand jury. 2 of them, Matt Duran and Kitty Olesnik, are in prison right now. One of them, Leah Plant, was in prison and has been released, and we don't really know what the story is there. Dennison, as he mentioned, he refused to appear, and his subpoena was dropped. We found out later that they're asking the other subpoenas about him, so we're assuming that he's a target of the investigation at this point. The 5th person is Maddie Pfeiffer, who was subpoenaed just a couple weeks ago and appeared on Wednesday of this week, last week, and was released partly because of the incompetence of the U.S. attorney. Like, they... Maddie's lawyer wasn't available on the day that they were subpoenaed, and let the U.S. attorney know that, and the U.S. attorney refused to move the date, and then the which doesn't really make much difference for a grand jury hearing, because you can't have a lawyer in there anyway, but did make a difference when it got to the contempt of court hearing. And so since Maddie didn't have representation, the judge granted a continuance, and so they will have their contempt hearing on December, I think, 15th. Is that right? Yeah. The expectation is that Maddie will probably go to prison then. In terms of some of the support work, some of that is some of the stuff that Dennison mentioned in terms of making sure that the material needs of the subpoenas are met, like making sure that there are going to be people to visit them in prison, making sure that there are going to be people who write them letters, making sure that they have money in their commissary fund so that they can, get stamps or food or whatever it is they need in prison. Helping them get the legal advice that they need, and making sure that there is somebody to, like, take care of their cat or whatever when they're incarcerated. And obviously that requires a certain amount of fundraising, so that's been a preoccupation of ours, but honestly it's been easier than I think any of us anticipated. The other main effort that we've had is doing media work around this and trying to make sure that people know about the case, make sure that people have the best information that's available in terms of who is resisting and how they're resisting and what the current status of the cases are, and also really trying to humanize the people who have been subpoenaed, and assuming that there are indictments coming later, to humanize the people who will be indicted, and to try to take hold of the narrative and tell the story about this that we want to tell, rather than just having the newspapers unanalytically report the story that the U.S. attorney or the FBI wants to tell about this. I don't know. Did I leave anything out there? Yeah, so that's basically what we've been doing. Also some stuff like this, like some public education things about what grand juries are and how they work and the importance of resisting them and how they can be resisted. And so if I'm going to stop there so that we have time for question and answer, and if you have questions, like, please don't hesitate when the time comes. Please.
Okay, thank you. My name is Richard Brown, and I am a resistor. I have been for over 50 years. It helps to be rebellious by nature, which I am. I've always rebelled against authority, so when it came to not cooperating with the police and the FBI and the CIA, Homeland Security, and anybody else associated with the government, it was easy for me to do that. But because I'm rebellious by nature, number one, and because, number two, I realized that I've learned that cooperating with the police or cooperating with grand juries always lead to problems for people. For you, they will never be honest with you. They'll never give you a fair shake. It's not in their nature to do that. Grand juries are used as tools in order to entrap people, in order to cast out a bigger net, bring in more people, place pressure on you, your friends, your community, in order to discourage people from any type of progressive thinking or progressive activities. It is not, if the police or the grand jury, if they seriously wanted to investigate crimes and try to do something to serve and protect or whatever that crap is that they claim, then they would, you know, maybe you might cooperate with them. Maybe you might want to do something. But that's not their job. Their job is to undermine any kind of progressive activity going on in the community. They want to beat people down. They want to put people in a position to where you feel like you don't have an opportunity or a chance to win at anything, which is a lie, because they're the ones technically who don't have a chance. I say most of the time when I start out speaking to people, I always say all power to the people. And that's because I believe, I know for a fact throughout my history, that a united people will always win. If you have the support of the people from your community and the locally and in the nationally and internationally, there's nothing that they can really do to you. I have been harassed by the FBI, by grand juries for so long, it's impossible for me to even remember when it all started. And they're not through with me, I know that. And I have to be prepared for that. In 2005, I was indicted, the grand jury indictment, federal grand jury. They wanted me to cooperate with them, myself and I think four or five other Panthers, ex-Panthers or Panthers. And we went about not cooperating with them. Actually, we didn't even have to communicate with each other. They brought us in from all different parts of the country, and we just decided, based upon our history, without even talking to anybody, that we were not going to cooperate. Naturally, I got an attorney. That's one of the things that you really need, is a good attorney. So you need very good legal representation. The other thing that you need is very good community support. Political support, your political community, you need them to support you. You have to also remember that you are not, it's important that you remember that you're not there as an individual. You are not resisting as an individual, and actually you can do that. There may be some people who are able to do that and do a very good job of it. I tend to be stronger when I know that I have something to fight for, when I'm fighting for my community or fighting for the people or fighting for my family. It's a whole lot more to me than, say, resisting just because I'm rebellious. That's not going to get it. But resisting for a cause, resisting for my community, resisting for the people and being supported by the people, it's what's always allowed me to be strong and to come out as a strong person, just as I've always been, always tried to be in dealing with the police or dealing with problems in my community. there, like I say, I do not believe that they're through with me. So in the future, it is important that I psych myself up and put myself in a position so I know that one of these mornings they're going to kick my door in at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, run in with all these guns, scared to death. The main thing that I'm afraid of is that they shake so much and they're so frightened that I'm scared that they'll pull the trigger. Honestly, they don't... You know, it's amazing how you can have 10 to 12 to 15 armed guys. Each of them have two or three guns, a bulletproof vest, shields, all pepper spray, tasers, shotguns, and they are afraid. And I'm at home sleep, you know, minding my own business like I am most of the time. Most of the time. I don't want to... go too far with that, but and they are more afraid, honestly, than I am. You know, it's not to say that I'm not afraid because I am, but I try at least to hide it, and they can't. So, now, in the future, they will probably come back. I was fortunate the last time in 2005 because we drug it out so long, and every time they would ask me a question, I would go outside and confer with my attorney. I would come back in, and I would take my time about, you know, they played games with me. The whole thing, as far as I'm concerned, was their way of screwing with me, so I screwed with them. I would even, some of the questions I made it appear as though I was really even thinking about answering the question, which I had no idea, none whatsoever. You know, they would say, well, did you know, ask the question? I would say, well, would you repeat that, please? And then I'd say, well, I'm going to go outside. And I'd go out and I'd come back and I'd say, no, on the fifth, I plead the fifth or whatever. We stalled so long that actually when they locked me up, offered me the partial immunity and full immunity, and I still said no. But I only had about 6 weeks to go before the life of the grand jury was up. They made sure that that was as horrible as possible. It's not a criminal offense, so you're not supposed to be treated as a criminal. It's civil, so you're supposed to be locked up differently, treated differently, allowed to have certain things that people who are convicted of a crime don't have. Of course, I didn't have that. They kept me isolated all the time in the hole, moving around so my attorney couldn't catch up with me, and just made life as miserable as possible. But 6 weeks, you can take anything in 6 weeks. So, but what I have to worry about and what I'm concerned about is if they come again and if I have to do the whole 18 months or close to that. And then knowing that they do not, they can refile and take you and put you back in after the 18 months is over. Again, I'm psyching myself up to the point to where I will hopefully be able to go through that. I'm pretty sure I will, especially if I have the support of the people. So I want to end by saying all power to the people, and thank you for the support that you gave me and the rest of the San Francisco 8. And if I need your help in the future, be there. Thank you.
So what we just heard there was a portion of the event that happened at the holdout on November 11th that was called Our Lips Are Sealed, Grand Jury Resistance and Grand Jury Defense. And this was an event that was really aimed at both informing people about what has been happening with a federal grand jury convened currently up in the Pacific Northwest that we've been hearing about and that we've been talking about some on the show here, as well as talking about ways to prepare, sort of learning lessons from historical struggles against grand juries here in the Bay Area, and just understanding sort of our legal rights, media strategies we can employ, and ways to sort of build a stronger political community to be prepared in the face of increasing and intensifying state repression. So just to sort of personalize a little bit of this this situation with the grand juries, rather than just talking in generalizations or sort of historically or more broadly about it, we wanted to share, to close out the show here, a letter that was written by Katie Olenek, who is one of the grand jury resistors. She was taken into custody up in Seattle, into federal custody. She's in a federal detention center currently, and she has been since September 28th. She was taken into custody for refusing to cooperate with the grand jury. She was the second activist subpoenaed in this grand jury process, and was the second one to be jailed for refusing to testify. So this is a letter from her that she sent out and that was posted on the website of the Committee Against Political Repression, and that website is nopoliticalrepression.wordpress.com. And this is a letter from KDO titled Mothers in Prison that was posted on November 4th. Hello, everyone. I wanted to start out, as always, by saying thank you for your support. What I want to talk about today is something that I have been touched on, something that I have touched on before in previous statements, but I wish to expand on. That is the problem many of my new friends face as mothers in prison. So many of these women work incredibly hard to keep custody of their children and to be good mothers, regardless of their situation. This is not an easy task. At the Federal Detention Center, in my unit, inmates can make up to $16 a month for their labor. 16. That means that while incarcerated, these mothers are unable to contribute to many issues of motherhood from prison. The financial side of aiding a child with incarcerated parents falls on other family members. Add to this the incredible cost of visits and phone calls, keeping in mind that $16 a month only buys you so much phone time. Many women have told me that they have had to choose between giving money to their children and hiring a lawyer, and this is only when money isn't really an issue. How many people do we all know for whom money is not an issue? The financial aspect of all of this is huge. In addition to the cost of visits, many inmates have trouble getting family members approved to bring their children, which can mean months before children can come visit. Even if everything is in order and money is not an issue, there's still only 300 minutes of telephone time a month and several hours of face-to-face time each week to connect with one's children, to aid in emotional growth, and to help with physical and emotional problems. Is that enough? I don't know. These are just some of the thoughts I've been wanting to share on the topic of prison doesn't just affect those incarcerated, but the whole family. So I hope you're all well. I'm doing okay, all things considered. I'm going to go play volleyball now. Keep smiling, keep struggling. In solidarity and love, KDO. So again, this letter was posted on the Committee Against Political Repression's website, nopoliticalrepression.wordpress.com. There are other statements that have been released by KDO and others who are currently in federal custody, and we encourage you all to check that out to get sort of direct accounts from those who are actively resisting this grand jury process. So we're going to finish off with some music, a little Rage Against the Machine, to wrap up your Sunday evening, and we hope that you will all tune in again with us next month. The first Sunday, I believe, falls on January 6th. We'll be here from 4 to 6 p.m. Again, this has been Radio Autonomía, Zapatismo in the Bay on Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 FM, berkeleyliberationradio.net. Let it out the family.
I'm gonna go get some more.